supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
The admitted mastermind behind Bridgegate is avoiding prison. I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. David Wildstein was handed a sentence of 3 years probation in federal court in Newark today. Details from WHYY's Joe Hernandez.
When it was his chance to speak in court, Wildstein said he was sorry. He apologized to his friends and family, to his former colleagues at the Port Authority, and to the citizens of New Jersey. He said his actions were stupid and wrong. He also blamed the culture in the administration of Governor Chris Christie, his high school classmate. Wildstein said, quote, "I willingly drank the Kool-Aid of a man I had known since I was 15 years old." The former influential political blogger will serve 3 years probation and complete 500 hours of community service. That's for his role in shutting down lanes leading to the George Washington Bridge to retaliate against the mayor of Fort Lee, who didn't endorse Christie for re-election. Judge Susan Wiginton called Wildstein's actions inexcusable, but said, quote, "It's important to note that only you have at least made any attempt to rectify some of your wrongs." Acting U.S. Attorney for New Jersey Bill Fitzpatrick praised the judge's ruling and said Wildstein's cooperation didn't guarantee a light sentence.
"It's not a get-out-of-jail-free card, but it is a fair and appropriate system in which people who substantially assist the government in the investigation and prosecution of others receive some tangible benefit for this. People don't come and cooperate because they want to necessarily be great Americans."
It's a different story for Wildstein's two co-defendants, former Christie administration official Bridget Ann Kelly and former Port Authority official Bill Baroni, were found guilty for their roles in Bridgegate last year. Kelly will serve 18 months in prison, while Baroni got 2 years behind bars. Both have filed appeals. Christie has denied any involvement or prior knowledge of the scheme and was never charged, but his statewide approval ratings have tanked throughout the nearly four-year ordeal. From the New Jersey desk, Joe Hernandez, WHYY News.
Philadelphia added two new community schools today. It added nine last year. Community schools also house non-educational programs to benefit the neighborhood as a whole, not just students. Mayor Jim Kenney says it was important to maintain some momentum in expanding the programs despite serious obstacles.
The newest community schools are Samuel Gompers Elementary School in far west Philadelphia and George Washington High School in the far northeast. George Washington senior Sana Amadi describes her neighborhood like this.
"I always tell people Northeast is one of my favorite neighborhoods in Philadelphia, and everyone's like, why? It's so boring, but it's so diverse. Like, just walking down the street, you'll hear like 20 different languages going on."
That ethnic diversity was key to Washington's selection. Also key was geographic diversity, says community schools director Susan Gabreski. Both schools selected are in neighborhoods far from Center City that were not touched by the first community schools cohort.
"One of the things we heard from Philadelphians when we did our community outreach work and our initial listening tour was how important it was for them to see this get to lots of places."
The new neighborhoods, however, are not especially needy. The first group of community schools tended to be in poorer areas. The first group was also a lot bigger. The city only named two schools this year because it's waiting on the outcome of a lawsuit challenging the city's sweetened beverage tax, which is being used to fund community schools. Mayor Kenney says he'd like to expand the initiative faster.
"And we're losing time over this stupid legal challenge. However, we will not lose momentum."
Despite this delay, the administration still plans to have 25 community schools up and running by the end of Kenney's first term. Avi Wolfinerant, WHYY News.
None of the 14 universities that comprise the Pennsylvania state system of higher education should close or merge. That's among recommendations of an outside consulting firm hired to help the state system solve financial and enrollment issues. Though Dennis Jones, president emeritus of the firm, presented the report today and had harsh words for the Board of Governors at its quarterly meeting in Harrisburg. He blamed university leaders, state lawmakers, and the system itself for the financial crisis the schools now face.
"There is nobody without culpability in this room. All parties have had a hand in digging the hole that the state system finds itself in."
Other recommendations include changing membership of the board governing the schools to those without political ties. Most of the current board members were appointed by the governor or state lawmakers. Other recommendations include changing the leadership model so it's not hierarchical and clarifies the authority among the board chancellor and universities. Reconfiguring universities facing the most severe sustainability challenges and bringing more faculty into academic policy conversations. Jones says it'll take the combined efforts of all to bring the schools back from the edge of financial ruin.
From a climate of distrust to a climate of trust, transparency, and collaboration, from back to the digging of the hole point, if folks aren't willing to work together, then nothing that we're saying is going to work.
The final report will be available next Friday and available to the public. Next steps include the board coming up with an action plan. The dream of developing the Delaware River waterfront was, until last week, fronted by Tom Corcoran, outgoing president of DRWC. Let's check in with Tom on where it's gone and where it's going to go. Tom Corcoran, welcome to Newsworks tonight.
Thanks, Dave.
The DRWC started in 2009 with what goals in mind?
It was started by Mayor Nutter. The goals were to do something different than had been done before. Our predecessor corporation, Penn's Landing Development Corporation, only controlled Penn's Landing. And so they naturally focused for their efforts for a long time on trying to reconnect Penn's Landing back to the city. And each time the projects were probably too ambitious and cost too much, and as a result, they never happened.
When you refer to reconnecting Penn's Landing to the city, is it primarily figuring out what to do with I-95 in the way?
Yes, yes. Everyone has always had the vision of trying to correct the original sin of that was made in the 70s when Penn's Landing was separated from the city and the whole waterfront was separated from the city. And again, our predecessor corporation tried with good intentions to find a solution to that. And that was the only land they controlled. When we were created, Mayor Nutter gave us a mandate with a greatly expanded mission to coordinate the redevelopment of a six-mile stretch of the Delaware, all the way from the big box stores in South Philly to Allegheny Avenue and from I-95 to the river.
As you mentioned Penn's Landing, that is back in the news just this past month. What's the latest development there?
On June 9th, we had a press conference with Mayor Kenney, Governor Wolf, the Secretary Leslie Richards of PennDOT, and the Janet Haas and the William Penn Foundation to announce that we had put together the funding, the entire funding for a $225 million project to finally reconnect the city back to its urban core.
What form will that take?
Instead of trying to cover large swaths of I-95, we picked one key location between Walnut and Chestnut, and with the idea of covering over I-95 and Columbus Boulevard, and then which would be a four-acre cap, and then with an 8-acre extension of a great new civic space that would be heavily landscaped down to the river. So creating a 12-acre addition to the civic life of the city.
So, Tom, what readily comes to mind among the major accomplishments and then about the challenges that lie ahead?
Well, I think our first major undertaking when we were created was to do a comprehensive master plan for this expanded area that Mayor Nutter put us in charge of in terms of coordinating development. And after that, we made a deliberate decision that we were not going to focus on Penn's Landing for the time being, that we were going to go north and south, do smaller projects, high impact. And as a result, what's happened very briefly is three spectacular new parks have been built at Ray Street Pier, Washington Avenue Pier, and Pier 68 in South Philadelphia next to the Walmart. We've done five connector streets, which taking streets that had been ill-lit and felt unsafe and putting in very high-quality lighting improvements, and also then establishing the beginnings of a waterfront trail that would be a 28-foot bidirectional bike trail separated from a pedestrian trail by landscape buffers. And this will eventually go the whole six-mile length of the waterfront. At the same time, we've had great success in placemaking activities. that really were not part of the original master plan to that extent. Spruce Street Harbor Park, we started 2014. We had hoped that maybe we would get 100,000 visitors the first year. We got 500,000. And it's now grown to about 750,000 people come every summer for over a four-month period. We took the old ice skating rink, but we also built a lodge and created a holiday-themed village all around it, which is now called Winterfest. And then just this summer, we added something called Summerfest, which is like a midway with new attractions, roller skating instead of ice skating, with rides and amusements. So altogether, more than a million new people are coming to Penn's Landing who weren't there before.
Tom Corcoran, thanks so much for joining us on Newsworks tonight.
You're quite welcome.
Tom Corcoran, outgoing president of the Delaware River Waterfront Corporation. The Trump White House is blaming Congress for slow-walking the president's nominees to fill out his cabinet, though some lawmakers from our region say the blame lies with the White House. WHYY Washington correspondent Matt Laszlo reports.
Around this point in Barack Obama's first term, the Senate had received 454 nominees from the White House. Donald Trump has sent just 216 nominees to the Senate, less than half as many. That frustrates Trump's fellow Republicans in Congress, including Pennsylvania Senator Pat Toomey.
I think we have way too many vacancies still, and there's probably some responsibility to go around for that.
The Trump administration accuses Senate Democrats of needlessly tying up some 130 nominees it has sent to the Senate. Fewer than 50 have been approved. And Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell says he's delaying his chamber's August break for 2 weeks to help clear the nominee backlog. So does it really matter that hundreds of key posts are unfilled? New Jersey Democratic Congressman Bill Pascrell says absolutely.
Those people who assist the cabinet members, the secretaries, the administrators, are valuable. They're there for a reason. So you listen to them. If you got a weak bench, it's going to show on the field, and it's showing on the field.
Pascrell worries the administration may be trying to cut the federal workforce by not filling the 382 empty positions in the administration that have yet to even see a nominee. He also suspects the White House is leaving key positions empty to exert more control over federal departments.
And he cannot resuscitate this if it's his pattern, and this is what he wants to do. Maybe to save a few dollars, maybe not to have the involvement of too many people in the inner sanctum. The inner sanctum is killing him. The inner sanctum is literally killing his agenda, which has become total discombobulated.
Each week, it seems either nominees drop out of consideration or pull their name out of the ring before they're even formally announced. Pascrell says the more that happens, the tougher it is to recruit new nominees.
So I could see a lot of people wanting to keep an arm's distance, and you're going to see that more and more.
But the White House is pushing back and laying the blame at Democrats' feet. South New Jersey Republican Congressman Tom MacArthur says he's heard Obama-era appointees are deliberately slowing down the process.
You know, I've talked to a number of people in the White House that have said their ability to fill these positions, it's not only being jammed by the Senate, but they have holdover departments from the last administration that are going through all the ethics forms that you have to file for all these people, and they're dragging their feet. So they're making it very hard for this administration to fill out positions.
MacArthur says the clogged nominee pipeline is preventing the president from getting his agenda through Congress.
Obviously, they want to fill these positions as quickly as they can. They're having a hard time moving their agenda without the right people in place.
For his part, MacArthur says the job of House Republicans is to keep moving on Trump's priorities while the Senate fights over nominees.
I think what we can do is keep the legislative agenda moving. The Senate will not initiate legislation on any of the big issues like health care or tax reform or financial service reform or entitlement reform because they don't have the bandwidth for it. I think they're being consumed by appointments. And so I think the House can keep the agenda moving legislatively. That's the best thing we can do.
Democrats don't like that the president is trying to paint their party as obstructionists. They gladly take that mantle for obstructing his legislative agenda. But when it comes to nominees, Philadelphia Democratic Congressman Brendan Boyle says they want the government to function better, even if that means filling it with more conservatives.
He'll attempt to blame Democrats. He'll attempt to blame Congress. Reality is this administration has been slower than any other to even make nominations to these very important positions.
Boyle serves on foreign policy committees, and while he opposes much of Trump's agenda, he says he wants the administration to quickly nominate people because the empty slots are hurting America's standing abroad.
Well, I can tell you again, from a foreign affairs perspective and the State Department, we're talking about the people who are our direct diplomatic links to other countries around the world, many of which are hotspots. So with these positions being vacant, we don't have anyone on the ground who's able to put the best face forward for the United States.
The White House is trying to pressure Democrats into quickly bringing up the remaining nominees that the Senate has yet to consider. That still leaves more than 380 posts with no nominee of the 564 that require Senate confirmation. For WHYY News, Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Philadelphia is best seen by foot. That's the premise behind Natalie Pompilio's book entitled Walking Philadelphia, 30 Tours Exploring Art, Architecture, History, and Little-Known Gems. Natalie, thanks for joining us on Newsworks tonight.
Happy to be here, Dave.
And this is in part a love story based on personal experience. You live in Queen Village.
I live in Queen Village, and I'm lucky enough to have my sister and her family 6 blocks from me.
And so what was the impetus to write this book?
I thought I knew a lot about Philadelphia, and then I started researching and realized I really didn't know that much, and it was fascinating.
It is a compilation of 30 different walking tours, and rather proud here at WHYY Studios, we're part of the number one tour, at least chronologically, in the book, Independence National Park, America's Most Historic Square Mile. So I'm curious, what was WHYY prior to WHYY on this space?
This used to be Pennsylvania Hall. Abolitionists built this in 1838, and at the dedication, John Quincy Adams came and said, "This is the best. I'm so proud of you all. This building's going to last forever." And then it was burned down a few days later.
You say this is not a definitive guide. Where do you foresee this in terms of the niche of guides and suggested tours?
I feel this is a really fun, really easy to use book. It's not definitive because I didn't expand enough beyond Center City. I'd love to go back and write about Northeast and all those different places.
Although you do have, for example, Manayunkin, Mount Airy.
True, but the Great Northeast is not mentioned, and I think they deserve it.
Not yet. Perhaps a second edition?
We hope so.
Each walking tour is rated by different criteria, distance, difficulty, parking, public transit. They're all easy to moderate walks, and moderate principally because of the duration, the number of miles, not so much the hills.
Except for Manayunk, which threw me off a little bit. It's a pretty flat city. And this walk shows that. I think the hardest walk when you're actually walking is Broad Street South because it just gets really hot.
And they're all 2 to 3 miles typically, so I'm doing the arithmetic, and you could, if one had the time and the means, do all 30 walks and it would come in at under 100 miles.
Way under 100 miles, yes.
And what was the process by which you compiled the maps and the points of interest on each tour?
If I could go back and do it again, I would do it much more efficiently. As I did it, I had my cell phone, and I was either walking or with my bike and just recording what I saw, sometimes turning left, saying, oh, wait, no, forget that, turn right, and it just came together that way. I should have really asked for help.
You took the long way around.
I did. It's not smart.
So you have a copy of the book with you, and I see it's marked in spots. What are some of the little-known gems that you picked up along the way?
One of my favorite things that I found was in Fairmount, and there's a park at 24th and Aspen. I drove by it last night, and it's dedicated to someone named Patrick Ward, and I never really thought much about it until I researched. I found a 1997 Philadelphia Inquirer article about it, and I literally teared up. It was beautiful. Patrick Ward was 21. He was killed in Vietnam. He was a helicopter gunner. And what gets you in the article is that his father was still alive, and they interviewed his father, and they were down the shore that day, and They heard there was trouble over Vietnam in the air. And he says, "Rough times for U.S. helicopters in Vietnam. I said to my wife, I hope our Patty's not up there." And then the next part of the story, you have the big brown army car coming down. So it made me much more engaged in things.
So let me put you on the spot. Not a word or even a phrase, but how about a paragraph or two? How would you sum up, if you had to, Philadelphia?
It is historic. It's fun. It's affordable, mostly. You can get anything you want here. We're nobody's little sister.
Natalie, thanks so much for joining us on NewsWorks tonight. Natalie Pompilio, her book is entitled Walking Philadelphia, 30 tours exploring art, architecture, history, and little-known gems. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. Thanks for joining us. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.